Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Call of Nature podcast. We are a grassroots podcast about nature, wildlife and the environment based here in the UK. And we're for everyday people just like you. So if it's the first time you've listened to the show, thanks very much for clicking on the button. We hope you enjoy it. And if you're a regular, then welcome back. So I'm joined today by Pete and Darwood. Hi, guys.
Hi, Chris.
Hey.
Hey, and Darwood, it's your first show here presenting with Pete and I, so welcome. We're glad to have you here, mate.
Thank you. Yeah, honoured to be here and excited to start, actually.
Great. So we've got a really interesting lineup today, I think. First up, we've got chats that Pete and Amanda had with Bev Phillips about sand dunes and some of the ecology of sand dunes, which was fun. Then Darwood is going to tell us about some of his favourite tiny creatures called tardigrades. And then we have a chat that Pete and Gareth had with a fellow nature podcaster, Sevin. But before all of that, Darwood is going to read out our legal disclaimer.
The views and opinions expressed in the Call of Nature are those of whoever expressed them and do not reflect those of any other organisation or agency.
Yeah, hi everyone, welcome to the Call of Nature. Thank you very much for listening, like Chris said. So at the beginning, as you may know, we like to chat about stuff that we've seen recently. Darwood, what have you seen lately?
It was about a week ago, because obviously we've been in lockdown and I haven't been able to see that much. But about a week ago, we went to a local nature reserve, actually, and we went to look at wading birds, because obviously for my course, I do marine biology. So we were just looking at water birds. And one of them that really stood out to me were the groups of lapwings that we went to see. So I used to go back home to my local nature reserve to see lapwings all the time. And it was really amazing to see these birds because they're absolutely stunning. They kind of remind me of Power Rangers. They've got sort of like a helmet on them and they're just really beautiful when they're flying. And just their pattern of flight is amazing. Really stunning birds. We saw a few other birds as well. Grey lag geese, moorhens, some oyster catchers, but lots of marine birds just all over the marshes that we went to. And that was just a really good time, I think.
Was that down at Farlington Marshes?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I forgot that you know where stuff is around here.
Yeah, well, I was born in Portsmouth and I love hanging around there. I was once told by a friend that there was an osprey there when I was driving past, so I pulled in, went to the car park, went and saw it, and Chris accused me of being a twitcher because I'd deliberately gone somewhere to see a bird. I thought you were a twitcher if you write things down. What's your view, Darwood?
I think, I don't know, because most of the twitchers I know have like lists and lists and lists of birds, but they do that. They go miles and miles out their way to see birds. But I think if it's an osprey, I don't think it counts, because I would, even if I wasn't a twitcher, I'd go miles to see an osprey.
There you go, Chris. Nothing wrong with twitchers, but I'm not one of them, it turns out. Thank you, Darwood. Score one for Pete.
We've cleared that.
Speaking of scores, do you want to say what you saw now?
Yeah, so I was out with Evie today, and we were walking along on the southwest coast path in between Paignton and somewhere else in the area. I'm not from around here, so I can never remember what anywhere's called. And she actually noticed this thing looked like a caterpillar that had been stuck onto a fence post with some yellow chewing gum or something. I took some photos of it. This caterpillar was totally dead and stuck on there fast, and I didn't know what it was. So I got home, uploaded it to Instagram, where Georgie, who we're interviewing in a few weeks, funnily enough, told me it was a caterpillar that had been attacked by a wasp and had one of these parasitic things stuck in it that Amanda was talking about on a previous episode, a couple of episodes ago. So you guys have seen it. What do you think?
Well, I mean, when I looked at it the first time, about two things came into my head, I think. One was wasp, because from what I've seen of wasps and what they do, and parasitic wasps and animals like that, is that they go and they catch the caterpillar first and they usually sting it. So it could have still been alive, but maybe just paralyzed, because sometimes they sting them and those caterpillars are then paralyzed and they lay eggs in them, and then they store them in a cold, dark place, or in this case perhaps on the side of that post and just in almost a cocoon if you will, and the larvae will then grow inside the caterpillar in that place and then burst out when they're ready. But it in my head it could have also been a spider, but then I think we talked about it, and it does seem that it's made of some sort of fiberglass filler, and so perhaps, like you said, the wasp was chewing away at the filler and decided to turn it into a storage material, because that's what wasps usually do. I know paper wasps take wood that they chew up and they turn it into nests and other structures. So I think that maybe that was what a species of parasitic wasp has done. Now, I don't know the species of wasp that maybe did that. I do know the caterpillar, if anyone wants to know. It's a scare stagger moth, I think.
It's that is certainly what I was thinking as well. I actually stuck this up on the Discover British Wildlife Facebook group as well, and someone who knows much more about this sort of thing than me, he said the same thing, Darwood. He reckons, and I looked at, I did some internet research as well, and apparently there's some species of wasps, and they lay their eggs inside caterpillars, and these eggs have the ability to like split into like other eggs before they hatch out, which is mad, really. And also sometimes they burst out of the host, the caterpillar, and they form this cocoon, which kind of like looks a little bit like what was on Pete's photo. But it sometimes it doesn't even kill the caterpillar, and the caterpillar's there like some like zombie parent protecting these little wasps as they turn into adults to continue their cycle of misery for these poor little caterpillars. God, wasps are assholes, aren't
I think it's got almost a horrific beauty to it, though. I think it's really fascinating.
It is, definitely.
Well, that was pretty gross. If anyone's interested, by the way, it's Monday the 16th of November, and if you look on our Instagram feed, you'll be able to see it right there, and that's at Call of Nature Pod. And that just leaves you, Chris. What you been looking at?
Well, I had a really nice outing the other day. It's something a lot less gruesome. I took my daughter to Slimbridge, which is run by the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust and isn't far from where I live. And we've not really had a day out for a long time, what with lockdown stuff, but it was a sort of one of those like really sunny and then like pissing hard with rain days. But we got to go to some bird hides. I was going to do a little piece on like different sorts of bird hide, but it's really hard to do to make any sort of podcast recording when you've got a 3-year-old child bugging you the whole time. But we did end up, there's one hide that's fairly close by to the visitor centre, and we sat and we talked about what we could see out of the hide, and I made a little recording, so I'm going to play that to you now. What's this duck doing here?
Having some fresh air.
Having some fresh air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's floating.
He's floating around, isn't he?
He's pretending duck.
He's pretending to
If
be a
he's
duck.
shivering.
No, what he's doing, he's sifting all of the mud for his beak, getting the food out of it. It's called a shoveler, that duck.
But I want it.
You want it?
Yeah.
Well, you want to take it home?
Yeah.
I don't think it would like living in our garden. It's too small.
Christmas present, so
Yeah. Our pond is only small. Well, because we haven't got a very big garden.
But the duck can stand there all day.
He can stand there all day. He might get lonely.
Why?
He needs his duck friends. So there we go. Everything's why. But it was nice to sit with my daughter, and there was a shoveler. If you couldn't hear, a shoveler duck, which is this duck that has a big flat bill, and it was squatting around for food right in front of the hide, which was nice. And we had a conversation about it.
Oh, that's lovely, Chris. I love it.
That's adorable. So I mentioned before that I'm really interested in conservation projects around the UK, and I know that a lot of our listeners are as well. And next up, we've got Amanda and Pete talking to someone about how sand dune projects affect conservation around the UK.
Bev's been working in the conservation sector for 10 years and she's now the Dunescapes Engagement Officer in North Devon. Hi, Bev.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Hi, Bev.
Hi, Pete. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Bev, what's the issue with dunes?
So dunes, they are a massively important habitat, but sadly, over time, many of our sand dune systems have become covered by grass and scrub and vegetation. And this has led to them becoming what we call overstabilized. And there isn't enough bare sand in these sand dune systems anymore, which is really, really important for very rare sand dune species. We've also got another problem that's happening on the sand dunes, that they've been taken over by invasive species.
I see. So what are your organisation doing about it, Bev, and who are you doing it with?
I work for a project called the Dynamic Dunescapes Project, and the project is funded by Heritage Lottery Fund and EU Life, and we're working with a whole range of partners and host organisations. So the National Trust, who I sit within in North Devon, various wildlife trusts, Plant Life, Natural England and Christie's Estate here in North Devon, who own and help manage the wonderful Braunton Burrows. So some of the things that we are doing across the UK and Wales is that we are working on particular sand dune systems. So we've identified some of the sand dune systems that will benefit from certain interventions. So, for example, at Braunton Burrows in North Devon, we're actually going to be removing a lot of this invasive scrub. So one of these invasive scrubs is known as sea buckthorn. And this is massively outcompeting all of the native species that we need on the sand dunes. And it's putting down a lot of roots and fixing these sand dunes. And we know that we need these sand dunes to be freely moving and to have beautiful areas of bare sand. So we're going to be going in and actually removing some of this scrub. Some of the other things that we're going to be doing is we're going to be creating what we call dune slacks, which are effectively ponds within the dune system, which might sound a bit strange that you're actually going to be putting water sources into habitats that you would think of as very dry habitats. But these ponds, these dune slacks, are really important for invertebrates, they're really important for birds, and they're really important for amphibian species that we actually have in sand dunes. So rare species like natterjack toads that thrive in these sand dune systems, they need these water sources. So we're going to be creating these dune slacks in some of the sand dune systems. Some of the other things that we're also going to be doing is introducing improved grazing regimes. So again, you kind of think grazing on sand dunes, but actually in Woolacombe in North Devon and in Studland in Dorset, we're actually introducing cattle onto the sand dune systems. And what these cattle do, they're fantastic at grazing these areas and breaking through all that dense shrub and scrub. And they don't eat any of the fresh shoots that are really important for pollinating and for those invertebrate species. So that's another thing that we are doing. We're also really, really keen to work with members of the public and the community and schools. So we're actually going to be running out lots and lots of events. We're going to be surveying and monitoring the species on the sand dunes. We're going to be looking at how the sand dune systems are changing and how these interventions that we're putting in are benefiting the sand dune systems. We're going to be getting schools out and about to learn about the sand dune systems. And just by being there, just their presence being there, will help break down and create areas of bare sand.
That's amazing. So I remember going on beaches where there were fences up everywhere and you weren't allowed to walk on bits. So this was the old way of doing, and it was actually the wrong thing to do then, you're saying.
Yeah, it was the wrong thing to do. We've learned a very hard lesson. So yeah, historically, sand dune systems, we put up fences and we told people to stay out. And that's totally contributed to all of this vegetation kind of fixing these sand dune systems. Now, don't get me wrong, there is definitely a necessity for fencing off certain areas of sand dune systems. So what we don't want to be doing is moving parts of sand dune systems that might be very close to roads, for example, or houses, for example. We don't want to suddenly be moving them and allowing that sand to be moving onto those houses and onto those roads. We also don't want trampling to be happening where we know we have particularly rare species. So we do need to keep people away from very certain areas. But overall, that idea of fencing off whole vast areas of sand dune systems has caused massive problems and has depleted the overall health of sand dune habitats.
So basically, walking on sand dunes is a good thing.
It is a good thing. And we want people to walk on sand dunes and to go and love the sand dunes. They're amazing places for recreation. There are amazing places to walk dogs. There are amazing places to just take some time out and really enjoy being outside in nature. And some of the wildlife that you can find in these sand dune systems are incredible. For example, at Braunton Burrows, we've got sand lizards at Braunton Burrows. They're one of the rarest lizards that we have in the UK. And if you see a male sand lizard, they're just glorious. They're bright green. They're beautiful. They're really large. And they really only live in sand dune or sand heathy environments. So you're not going to see them in many other environments. So you're absolutely full of wildlife.
Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you, Bev.
Yeah, really brilliant. So can you tell us how people can get involved, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a whole range of ways that people can get involved with the Dunescapes project. So just one of the many things that we are delivering within the project is actually an environmental award. And this is the John Muir Environmental Award. So if you are a parent or family and you are looking for ways to get out and about, learn about sand dune systems, then we have already developed this John Muir Award. So please do get in contact with me and I will leave some details at the end of this for how you can contact me and find out more about how you could go out and achieve this education award. We also do have lots of volunteering opportunities. As I mentioned before, we have plenty of surveying and monitoring opportunities. So we'd be surveying bees, butterflies, plant species, and we want to see how these practical changes that we're making on the sand dunes have an effect on these species. So if you want to get out and get some experience with surveying and monitoring, then we definitely have opportunities for you. We also are going to be undertaking this scrub clearance and removing of invasive species at Braunton Burrows. So we would love you to come along and be involved in helping us clear this scrub and just come along to this beautiful sand dune system site. We also have 3 12-month research placements available. So if you want to come along, learn about the sand dunes, get involved with practical habitat management as well, education, events, research, then get in touch. If you're a teacher, we're currently creating a whole realm of online educational resources that will be available to teachers and parents. So again, get in touch with me, discuss anything that you're interested in, and we can develop these programs for you as well. So to do this, email me. And so this is beverly.phillips@nationaltrust.org.uk. Or you can get in touch via Instagram or Facebook at Dynamic Dunes.
Great. Well, it's been really nice chatting to you, Bev. And good luck with all the great work. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Amanda.
Well, it sounds like sand dunes in the UK are in really good hands with Bev. I was a bit surprised by how much they benefit from not being fenced away. I guess that goes to show that sometimes the best way to manage land for nature isn't always the most obvious solution. By the way, Bev is Phillips with two L's. So the email address that she gave you would be beverly.phillips with two L's at nationaltrust.org.uk. So next up, Darwood is going to tell us about some fantastic little creatures that most people haven't even heard of, but they certainly are very interesting.
Okay, so thanks, Chris. Tardigrades, absolutely incredible organisms. It's almost like they're from another planet. They definitely look like something off Star Trek. Tardigrades are extremely small organisms, ranging from about 1 millimeter in size, and they have about four pairs of legs. And actually their name, tardigrada, means slow stepper, because they're quite small organisms and they move very slowly in the environments they exist in. Now, obviously, their official name is tardigrade, but they've also been nicknamed water bears and moss piglets, mainly because of the way they look. They're sort of like very small segmented worms with tiny, tiny little legs with little claws on them so that they can claw their way through the undergrowth or whatever environment they exist in. So a really interesting thing that I found out about tardigrades when I was reading up about them is that there's actually more than 1,000 species of tardigrades. So it isn't just one individual organism. There's lots of different types of them. And the reason that there's so many different types of tardigrades is because they've evolved to live in so many different environments. So I listened to a previous episode where Amanda was talking about wasps, and she said that the only place you can escape from wasps is Antarctica. And really not so with tardigrades. You can't really get anywhere to escape from them. They live everywhere you can possibly think of on the planet. And in living in all of these different environments, they've obviously evolved different ways of coping with all of these different areas, which I think is what they're most famous for. So when I learn about tardigrades in school, and when I've heard other people talk about them, it's mainly because they are this extreme environmental creature. They live in so many extreme environments with so many different extreme conditions they can withstand. So, for example, they can withstand extremely low temperatures and desiccation. So desiccation means extreme drying. So it's when something is dried out to the point where there's no water there at all. And that was really, really interesting to me, because when I think about extreme drying, and when you think about extreme drying in lots of different organisms, it really is one of the main things that causes animals to die, because that amount of water that is taken out of cells means that the cells collapse, because the cell structure, especially in animal cells, is held by the amount of water or the level of water that is in that cell. So once you take away all that water, the cell collapses and the animal basically collapses from the inside out and dies. But not so with tardigrades. And it's really fascinating because inside the cell of a tardigrade, and they've noticed this in the cells of dehydrated tardigrades, is a protein called TDP. And what this does is it replaces that water that was normally in the cell before, and it forms a substance like glass. And this keeps the cell structure, which means that they don't collapse. So these tardigrades can basically withstand conditions where they've been completely dried out and all the water's been taken out of their body, but because these cells are still, they still hold their structure, they can still hold their bodily structure and come back to life, which is another thing that I really am interested in when I look at them. So when the conditions go bad and they become unfavorable to tardigrades, they go into this thing called suspended animation, which again kind of makes them seem like something off Star Trek, because that's the only other place I've heard of any organism going into this state. So what happens is their body will dry out, so as I've just talked about, and when people looked at it under a microscope, they appear as these little lifeless balls, which you call a TUN state. So that's T-U-N. So a TUN state, which is when a tardigrade has basically gone into this state where it is just this little husk. And what's amazing, again, about this state of them is that they can survive years and even decades in this state. Basically, they're waiting for the conditions to get better. And so they're staying in this almost seed-like state until the conditions have become favorable again, in which case they can come out of suspended animation. So whilst they're in this suspended animation, their metabolism actually slows to as little as almost 0.01% of its normal rate, which is very good, because obviously that means they can conserve energy. And because they're in suspended animation, there's no water being used and there's barely any energy being used, which means they can stay in it for longer. we apparently were very mean to these little creatures because we put them through so many experiments that have almost killed them. So one experiment that I read about that's really shown their hardiness, I think, is that they were exposed to these really extreme conditions that any other organism would have died under. So they were kept for 8 days in a vacuum. So bearing in mind that a vacuum is an environment where there's no air, not even air can exist. So they were kept in 8 days in a vacuum, and then they were exposed to a number of hours of almost minus 300 degrees centigrade temperature. And they were kept in these environments for a few days, and then they were brought back into room temperature and brought back to life, basically. So by injecting them back into these perfect temperatures and with a reasonable water supply, they basically came back to life and were reanimated.
Amazing thing.
So it's a really amazing thing, I think. And it's actually what has allowed them to be the only animal, I think, and the only organism, to my knowledge, that has survived all five extinction events.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So as I've said before, they survived in a vacuum, which obviously I think to many people who know what a vacuum is, means space, because space is a vacuum. So a lot of theories suggested that tardigrades can actually survive in space. And a few experiments have been tried out where they've been put into space and exposed to the radiation in space and the vacuum and then brought back down again. And when they were put into space, I think in one experiment that I read about, they were brought back down and reanimated, and they were able to survive and reproduce. They then died after that, so we're not really sure that they can actually survive in space. But for enough time for them to actually reproduce and produce more of a colony, they were able to survive, which provides some evidence that they could actually survive if conditions were slightly less insane than space. And they also, well, they reproduce asexually, which means that they don't actually need another tardigrade to reproduce. So you can get one tardigrade, and when it becomes this ton state, as I've talked before, it can be blown around into any other environment. And when they settle in that environment, they then can just asexually reproduce and produce this giant colony all on their own, which is really, really cool, I think. And something, one more thing, which makes me think that they are definitely, at least if they're not aliens now, they will be in the future. So in 2019, there was a lunar lander, an Israeli lunar lander. And what it did was it crashed onto the moon's surface, which obviously meant that its mission wasn't going to happen anymore. But part of its cargo contained a colony of tardigrades. And so scientists think that this colony of tardigrades is still on the moon. And whether or not they're in suspended animation or existing there now as living organisms, we don't know. But it's highly likely that they could survive in space. So why not?
Wow. So I'm looking at a picture of one of these things. Have you heard of these before, Chris?
I had heard of them a bit. Yeah, yeah.
I've heard the word before, and I've seen a picture of this unbelievably cute alien-looking thing with, I mean, blimey, it's got its nose looks like a Hoover attachment.
You should hear what it says about your nose, mate. Yeah.
It looks like a sort of cartoon alien hippo, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good description. They're so tough, aren't they? I just like when you were describing the experiments that we've done to them, to sort of see how, you know, put them under the worst possible conditions to see what will kill them. And they probably just saunter out dancing, going, come on, give me some more. What is that, what we got? Incredible.
I think we're very lucky that they're not bigger.
Yeah, totally.
They're not going to be very pleased with us, are they?
Yeah.
Let's hope that their big brothers don't turn up on the next comet. And I don't suppose you happen to read about when we're going back to the moon to find out if they're still wandering around up there, Darwood?
For now, I haven't read any more about it, but I think it's more of a theoretical thing at this point. Probably because they probably can't get the funding to go and see if there's some tardigrades on the moon. Although I think there's been evidence of tardigrades surviving in sort of ice blocks and ice sheets. So anywhere where there's frozen water, really, they could probably survive no matter what conditions there are. So, well, we have frozen water on other planets in our solar system.
Indeed.
So it's quite possible that if we put them there, they probably would be able to survive, even if it was just in suspended animation.
I love the idea of, you know, for years and years and years, you know, humanity has been searching for extraterrestrial life by staring out into space and building more powerful telescopes. And it may very well be that all they needed to do was look under their fingernails. Well, there we go. Tardigrades. Weird little things. As you may or may not know, there are many great nature podcasts out there at the moment. Many of which have only started fairly recently, just like us. And over the course of this series, we'll be chatting to a few other like-minded people about their shows. And we're going to start out now with Sevim and her show.
Hi, Sevim. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So, everybody, we're chatting with Sevim, as you can tell, who recently studied zoo biology for 3 years and is now studying a master's in documentary making.
And Sevim, one of the things we're really interested to hear about was you're the host of the Be Curious Beings podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about how you started it, what it's about?
Sure. I started Be Curious Beings. It's actually quite funny, actually. I was on placement year and I was sat in a room. I was a researcher for a project looking at roadkill. And I was also studying for my dissertation on illegal wildlife trade within elephants and rhinos. And I had completed all my tasks and I was just sat on my chair, just tapping a pen against my chin, because I'm pretty sure that's where all good ideas come from. and it rolled off the tongue very, very nicely. So I thought, okay, let's go into it and see what happens. And so Curious came from when I was a kid. I always loved going into nature. I always liked the trees. I kind of like touching the trees and getting the textures and why is it like this shape and what happened in its history. And I've always liked climbing mud hills. I'm always really engaged with where I am, and that's where it really came from, especially with the sound of rain. I always ask questions about the ecosystems, about environments, about species, and how this delicate ecosystem and environment work together to succeed or to fail depending on what circumstance it is. And then it really came down to beings, which is ultimately from human beings. We all live on this planet. And I figured this was a really good chance for me to try and delve into something new. And the minute I said it, it really rolled off the tongue.
I've had a look and it's quite a wide variety of stuff that you explore, which looks really interesting. So what sort of things can people expect from the podcast?
People can really, you can really expect just, like you said, I really agree, a variety of different things to do with conservation science. I'm a lover of nature. I love learning all the time. I love broadening my knowledge. I like inspiring and, you know, influencing people, and even for my self-awareness, really. I really love that aspect of learning. They can delve into something new, something about the environment. It doesn't have to be the environment. I had a friend on talking about how she became an ecologist. So it's a really big variety of things, and it's from hobbyists to naturalists to specialists to professionals, and it's just a variety of fun facts, really, and then my really boring voice on top.
Well, that's definitely not the case, but I think one of the bits I've been listening to actually is when you had a chat with a technologist, which is fascinating, and it's a really interesting insight of the view of how, you know, we can sometimes see the modern world as being one of the reasons that wildlife and ecosystems are under threat, but actually it can also be part of the solution. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that came out of that discussion?
Sure. I actually was really quite cautious about this episode because I didn't know how it would go. So I asked my brother and he happily agreed. And the things that he was saying to do with green cloud and greener living and learning how to use the internet to benefit the environment. And I found that fascinating. So It's ultimately things like turning your laptop off completely. Don't put it on sleep mode because it still uses energy. Turning your phone off at night, turning your lights off and things like that. And he talks about companies such as Google, Apple, Facebook, Instagram. Companies like that are trying to make positive changes to the environment, as well as implementing green walls and green roofs to really promote species and ecosystems and that natural cycle that it's supposed to be.
That was a fascinating episode, Sevim, and you can tell your brother that I was trying to do the green thing by limping on with my phone 2 years after I got it, you know, when the contract ran out. And I thought, I'll get SIM only, do the right thing. But after listening to your brother, I realised that I'm not doing the environment any favours by having a phone that I have to charge up 3 or 4 times a day. So I've actually ordered a new battery for it. So please thank him for that. Well, Sevim, you're a new podcaster. We're new podcasters. So I want to ask, how are you enjoying it so far?
You know, I'm really, really enjoying it. I'm really enjoying the aspect of developing my own self-awareness, developing an Instagram page and really seeing other people's stories and photos, which make me so, so happy. I always thought that it was just me in my head that I'm only doing all this. And it's just amazing to see that people are going out into nature, taking photos and really seeing the generosity that nature is giving us every single day. And for me, that makes me so happy and a little bit emotional, because it's really starting to show and have an impact on people's lives, especially with people with depression and anxiety. I'm, for one, have experienced that, and podcasts and going out into nature has really, really helped me. So I think that's the aspect I've really enjoyed seeing, is seeing other people's journeys and photos. It's been a really cool journey so far. I'm really enjoying it. How about you guys?
Oh, I'm loving it. We've got chatting to loads of cool people, haven't we, Gareth? We feel like people are enjoying it. It seems, aren't they? How about you, Gareth?
Yeah, I love just hearing people's different stories and perspectives. It's just bits about that people can share with you that can just enrich your life, can't they? And it's just been brilliant. Right. So thank you very much, Sabine, for joining us. And if you want to go and have a listen to BQ Experience, which we definitely recommend, you're on Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Podbean. So have a listen.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy what you guys are doing, and I really, really enjoy the podcasts. They really help me so much. Thank you.
Well, it's really nice to hear from people on the same mission as us, isn't it, guys?
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Sevim.
And remember, you don't have to start a nature podcast to be on a nature podcast. If you've got a cool story about a cool project or a cool animal or a cool plant or a nice place that you want to share with the world, then the Call of Nature podcast is your platform to do so. So get in touch with us.
And speaking of podcasts, don't forget to have a listen to Be Curious Beings, which coincidentally has our very own Dr. Gareth on the episode Utterly Fascinating Facts About Nature, which is surprisingly about otters, a subject which he's quite a specialist in.
Yeah, he knows his otters.
You have been listening to episode 12 of The Call of Nature. Thank you very much indeed for listening. If you're of a mind to, then we'd be very grateful if you would please be prepared to give us a review or a rating wherever you download your podcasts from. That'd be super cool. Just like Chris. Bye, Chris.
Bye, Pete.
And Darwood. Bye, Darwood.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.